Founders, welcome back to the Zero to 5,000 podcast, where we obsess over the convergence of human potential and business results. Today, our hosts Drew McClure and Jordan Mitchell have another insightful conversation for you. So let's jump right in.
Okay, founders, welcome back to the podcast. Today, we are joined by Matthias Rialfi. Matthias is the co-founder and CEO of Tint. Before this, he was the director of international expansion at Turo and launched the company in Canada, the UK, and Germany. He pioneered the operations, including designing risk management in different stages of the company and sourcing insurance in various countries. He is a licensed insurance broker in all 50 states, holds an MBA from Harvard Business School and a dual degree in business from the University of Sao Paulo and Kedge Business School. And today, to tell us about his own entrepreneurial journey, is Matthias. Matthias, thank you for being here, buddy.
Hi, Drew. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Excited to get to know you some. So how did this get started? Where did Tint come from, the idea? What led to this business being born?
Yeah, so Tint was born as a product that we wished existed as we were working at Turo. So both my co-founder, Jerome, and I were early employees at Turo. We joined the company around 2013, when it was like a 15 people team. And we, for like different reasons, ended up working in insurance. So I was the head of international. So creating new markets is pretty much creating a new insurance product for Turo. And my co-founder, he was the head of data science and engineering. So he was working a lot with the kind of underwriting of the models, the data stack that would calculate prices and measure risks and things like that. So we both, you know, by accident got into this this kind of insurance world that we neither were anticipated ever working with. We both loved it. As we were building that at Turo, we saw the opportunity and how Turo was becoming a huge driver, our insurance was becoming a huge driver of the Turo business and creating a lot of value for users, really enabling the core business to exist and thrive. But we also saw how hard it was for a company that was not a tech company without an insurance DNA, trying to build all of this in-house with no help, not like no partners, no technology. And no, it was a multi-year journey, like 7+ year journey to get good at it. And we were like, well, as founders, as entrepreneurial people, it's like, well, isn't that an opportunity that we can get out and build a company that will offer what we're building here, Turo, for others, for like any brand out there in any vertical that could benefit from having insurance as part of their products and services, or as a feature of their product and services. So that was really the origin story of Tint. And then we found Tint about almost like 6 years ago now. And then we've been in this journey of like, you know, different, as a founder journey, never linear, like in different angles, in exploring how to, you know, deliver on this original idea. How can we help any brand in any vertical create insurance products that, like, you know, help them accelerate the core business and make more money in the process?
So for Turo, was the insurance that you were having to figure out, was that for the person that's like saying, hey, I'm going to let my car be available for rent? And how does that work if there's an accident or an injury? Is that kind of what the feature was?
That's right. So the thing about Turo is a peer-to-peer car sharing marketplace. So they connect people with cars or drivers who want to use cars. And you can rent like, you know, as fancy as a car as you want there, including Ferraris and all the way to like, you know, simple cars. As I'm renting your car, what happens if there's an accident? What happens if I steal your car and never come back? Like, you know, there are many things that can go wrong. And you as an owner, you want that security that whatever happens, you are protected, right? Like you were going to be made whole. And as a driver, I would also want to make sure that I'm not on the hook for potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars of losses if anything happens in my trip. And I think, you know, that's the kind of assurance or a protection product that Turo offered. And, you know, it took like, you know, almost 2 years for the company to come up with the first version of this product. Like, insurance is a highly regulated, highly complicated market. And, you know, we see that now, that was our inspiration use case. But for example, now we work with a company for U-Ship. So you can ship things from anywhere to anywhere in the US. So say shipping a car or shipping a bicycle or shipping furniture, whatever you want from, say, Boston to San Francisco. And things may break, right? Like, if things are moving, right, they may break. So we work with UShip. We created a way that they just, as you're purchasing the moving service, you see a box that say, for another $50, do you want to add protection to this trip? So if there's any damage to your car, to your furniture, whatever, you are covered. And that's kind of another example of a use case that companies can use to make insurance a better, make their core business better.
Right. So what I'm curious about is, you know, insurance obviously already exists. Businesses offering insurance for things already exists. But you mentioned you wish that there were capabilities or maybe the ease of building that out that wasn't there. What was the actual thing that you spotted where you're like, hey, we could create a company that does this better?
Yeah, I think, you know, is a story, or like, if you think about any SaaS, right? Like, most SaaS, they are replacing something that already existed, but it was done poorly, inefficient. So, and I think the same story for us, right? So we see ourselves in a way as a SaaS or this infrastructure that helps power the company, different insurance products and different pieces and whatever complexities that they need. And, you know, can they do it by themselves and put all the pieces together? They can. We did that at Turo, so of course they can. But should they do that? The answer is no, right? Because if we can do our jobs and create a better infrastructure, a better SaaS, they can use to build on top and really leapfrog all this complexity and spend a lot less money than if they were to do in-house, they should do it. The same way that any company can own servers, and actually before AWS, they all did it. But it doesn't mean that today, as you're running a company, you should have a full building dedicated for servers. You just should pay Amazon or Microsoft or whatever, one of those cloud solutions, because it's a much better business outcome for you.
Makes sense. So what I'm always curious about is the time from when you're working at, you know, for you, it's Turo, but for somebody else, they might be working a different job and they have this idea and the idea is kind of germinating inside of them. Mm-hmm. But then there's the, when did I decide I was actually going to take the leap and actually build this thing from an idea to a reality? What was that for you?
I mean, you're right that I always, like, you know, from, I've always been looking for ideas to build. So my background is, like, I'm originally from Brazil. I came to the US to go to business school. And the reason why I came is that I wanted to launch global businesses. And I think that this is the best place in the world, and especially for technology, I think it was Silicon Valley. So that's a little bit of what I did. So, you know, even when I joined Turo, I was joining Turo to acquire some skills that I think were required for me to start a successful venture capital business in the US. For example, I didn't have the connections. So other than my business school network, I didn't know anybody in the US. So that's a hard to build a business when you don't have connections for your first investors, your first customers. I had never seen how to run a world-class startup. And I, you know, again, throughout my 4 years at Turo, the company scaled from 15 to 400 people, highly successful. So, like, I was able to participate, but also experience what it looks like. And the last thing is, like, you know, it's having a problem that you have experience with that you think is you can solve. So again, throughout this entire process of this 4 years at Turo, we solved this problem for firsthand. We were able to learn and become potentially the best specialists in the world, right? So as a founder, it's very important to be solving problems that you experience firsthand, because that gives you typical insights that others. And one question I have all the time is, like, how did you get your embedded insurance? That's so weird and niche. Like, how do you even think about it? Like, well, we worked on that for 4 years, right? We solved the problem, we experienced. And then to your point, I'm not sure if I remember exactly what was the time when we said, okay, now we're ready, let's go. But that was built over now 3.5 years working at Turo. I think we made a decision I think it was about 6 months before we left the company, communicated to the CEO who ended up being our first check, our first angel check. And then, you know, it took me 6 year transition each from tour to tank. But long way of saying that, like, yeah, it's, for me, it was a gradual process that was intentional and gradual that was building over a few years.
Man, the fact that you were able to build that transition out and have your former employer be one of your first investors, I think is a really beautiful story, because many people don't know how to transition, chase a dream, leave a company without burning a bridge. You know, how did you accomplish that?
Yeah, but that's a very important point. I would say the way I accomplished that is to be transparent and understanding. So as I mentioned, I ended up staying 6 months from the date that we agreed that I was going to leave to when I actually left, because I was working through some important launches internationally, some important projects. So I stayed 6 years to close those out and transition. And I think that bought me a lot of, like, you know, I had worked with the CEO for 3.5 years. So I think we already had a great working relationship. But that last mile, I think, was very important, because some people just say, you know what, I'm in the US, I have a 2 week notice period, I'm off in 2 weeks, good luck, it's not my problem anymore. Like, that doesn't build long-term relationships, right? And I think I was very intentional about doing that. And the other thing is, like, my former boss, he knew me, right? Like, he knew I was a founder. He tried it. It was funny. I will never remember the call when I told him. It was like, hey, I want to leave. I want to start my own business. I think he tried to convince me for about 10 minutes to stay. Like, no, why? We'll give you more scope, or we'll give you a promotion, whatever it is. But it was like 10 minutes, because he knew deep down that was not going to be what would get me the most excited. He knew me. He knew I could be a founder. And he had gone through the same journey himself. So he went very quickly from, sure, let's do it, I will support. Now let's make sure we have a transition plan in place so Turo doesn't suffer from your departure.
I love that. Yeah, the transparency, he actually knows you. It takes emotional maturity on his side too. That speaks to him as a leader to, you know, recognize, hey, I'm not the only person here with a dream. I'm not the only person here with a skill set. Why would I get in the way of that, right? Mm-hmm. But you caring for his thing and showing I'm going to leave it better, you know, than I found it. I mean, reputation goes a long way. And as big as the world is, it's also small in terms of, you know, one CEO talking to another and saying, hey, this guy really, really is untrustworthy or whatever. And that could impact your business, versus saying, no, he used to work for me, he's great, we support what he's doing. That can go a long way in helping your new business, correct?
Yes, and that's what happened to us. So as I mentioned, he was the first angel check that we had. And the first institutional check was his former boss, because our first check was, the institutional check was from this company called Web Investment Network that is run by Maynard Webb, who was the COO of eBay in eBay's heydays, like when eBay was, you know, Facebook and Amazon of today, right? Then, so this guy, you know, knows everybody in the Valley, is an amazing mentor, an amazing kind of investor. And Andre is part of the network of the web, the Wing company. So I remember waking up, I was in London because I was still living in London and before I came back to the Bay Area. And I wake up with this email that is a thread between Andre introducing us to Maynard, and then, like, that led to our first institutional check. And to your point, like, had I not, you know, kind of planted the seeds and being a thoughtful, respectful, responsible employee while on my time in Turo, I would not have access to that kind of things, and it really kind of jumpstart our process as we were working with teams.
What was that first year like?
I mean, first year for us was trial and error and trying to figure out a direction. So if you think about, like, you know, we are almost 6 years old, as I mentioned, and our core product, what we sell today, is probably 2.5 years old. Or let's call it maybe 3. So it means that, like, you know, half of our journey so far has been exploring, has been launching a product, getting initial traction, but then seeing that that was not enough to go to the next stage, And I think our first year was a lot of that, was a lot of like, okay, we have this crazy vision. If this vision works, we're going to reinvent the entire insurance industry. That's obviously a massive undertaking. How do we figure out whether the passive list resistance should get this journey going? And that was all our first, honestly, our first 3 years of the company were. And then we got to a point where we found it out. And that's when the our company started to scale. But yeah, lots of trial and error.
Yeah. What was the major kind of learning that you had as the founder in those first years where you're going through the iterations, you're going through the learning curve? What did you learn was kind of needed on your part to do that well?
I think as a founder, I'll go back to very principle basic from Y Combinator, which is talk to your customers. I think as founders, like, there are different ways that we can get information, that we can get inspiration. I think as a founder, you need to have a vision and you need to have opinions on things, because that's what you bring to the world. Like, if you cannot have the unique insight, then it's likely you're not going to succeed as a company. But even if you have insights, there's a market out there. It's all hypotheses and they're in the early days. You're going to be right in a few of them. You're going to be wrong in some. So getting that, like, getting good as an early stage to 0 to 1 founder, to going out there, have access to potential customers, being good and get distilling the learnings that you're not necessarily going to build what they're telling you. Because again, going back to Henry Ford, right? If I ask what my customers want, they would tell me faster horses. That is true for the most part. So, or Steve Jobs, right? Nobody would ask me for an iPhone. Like, that is the job as you as a founding team to figure the solution. But at least be out there spending a disproportionate amount of time uncovering insights, uncovering problems from customers, and going back to build. I think in hindsight, we were a specialist, as I mentioned. We were building those things for Turo. So we had strong hypotheses of things, how they should work, and frankly, how customers should behave. And we were wrong in many of those, or we were right, but it was too niche, and then there was not enough of them. And like, so I think we learned a lot in the early days about how to navigate that. I think if we were to do it again, those first 3 years that I mentioned, we could probably compress them in 6 months, maybe one, just by being more efficient and knowing how to do it.
What surprised you most? Like, in the assumption that we had this assumption, we thought the market wanted this or needed this, and we were surprised that actually it was this over here.
I think what surprised most, again, where our domain is team.ai, right? So our first angle was pure AI. And it was back in 2018, before ChatGPT. There was still a hype around AI, but like not nearly as much as today. And what surprised me the most is that, think about, we were designing, like to say, we're designing the engine of a Ferrari that arguably and technically is probably the world class, the best technology, the best you can get as far as an engine goes. But then we learned, it's like, well, most of the market wants Honda Civics or Tesla 3s, and there's no point designing this kind of fancy engine that they mean that very few people would actually use it. So I think that was, again, hindsight, our mistake is like designing for power users like us. That is not where the market is. Like, to this day, 6 years later, embedded insurance is in its infancy, right? Everybody believes that this is going to change insurance. It's a multi-trillion dollar opportunity. But the reality is, like, there's just the early adopters are starting to tinker with this concept. So you're already selling a product to the most sophisticated mainstream customers. And there was a gap there. And I think we learned, we adapted, and today we almost like sell the Tesla 3 instead of, and the full car, or it's turnkey, plug and play, as opposed to selling the most sophisticated engine and getting them to go build the rest of the car by themselves and a luxury car, right?
That makes total sense. Now, how does AI fit into this?
Yeah, so again, the main thing we're doing, like, AI, it's going to fit in many different ways to deliver insurance experience, right? From the price you see, it's going to be AI powered. And that's kind of how we started. Our first product was a AI or machine learning powered score to assess risk in real time. So going back to the true example, when you're trying to rent that Porsche in LA for that specific date, with your age, with your, you know, browsing experience, whatever things that it can be factored, how can we in real time spin up a number that tells the company this is high risk? So either you don't let that happen or price it higher, or this is low risk. Like, how do we do this access in real time? That's where AI eventually is going to play out, because the price you pay, whatever, it's going to be defined by a complex machine learning algorithm. But AI can help with operations, can help with claims. Like, how do you adjust the claim? Suppose the tour example again, there was a scratch. You send a photo, it is real. You compare photos before and after. You see that now you caused that. And you can get, like, it costs $300 to fix. AI can solve that. You can compare the two photos. You can get a sense of how much it costs to fix. And if it's below a certain threshold, pay directly. Don't even ask questions. Versus having a human on the loop where it's like, spend time. It's going to have to go ask questions, whatever. Like, may not be required for a $500 claim. But what if you had an accident that you totaled a Porsche? Well, different story, right? So then, of course, you need a lot of human intervention. So that's another place. And the last one is customer support. Like, for sure, you have questions about, is this covered? Like, that should be answered by AI. You don't probably don't need a human, because it's just knowing what is the coverage, what is the question, and matching. So we've seen that, like, you know, AI is going to get efficiency, like this process a lot more efficient. And that's kind of what we're building as part of our company and our DNA, is that we will work with all of that so that the infrastructure that we offer companies will come with AI built in.
Cool. This may be a dumb question, but again, it's obvious, but has the kind of recent jumps, I guess, in technology with OpenAI and ChatGPT and all of its, all the resources going there, has that accelerated even the capability that you were previously working on with AI and what it can do for your product and service?
Yeah, absolutely. Because again, the two parts of the claims management, the customer support or FAQs perspective, like, that can be really accelerated with ChatGPT or with the GPT models, right? And having that capability via API off the shelf, it does accelerate. We are definitely building on top of it and exploring and kind of finding ways that, like, are faster than what we could do before.
Cool. For you personally, you know, you had a dream of coming here and starting a business, and now you're getting to do it. What, just from a personal experience, what has it been like for you actually getting to start something, scale something, be kind of in that founder seat, co-founder seat, either way, but kind of leading this thing? What has that experience been like for you?
It's been, overall an amazing experience, right? Obviously the founder journey has a lot of ups and downs. Some days you think you're going to conquer the world and, like, this is obvious, this is going to change the world. Some days it's like, what the hell I'm doing? Like, this is not moving at the speed I would like, or maybe there's not. Like, so it's inevitable go to these ups and downs, but I would say overall the journey has been amazing, right? So I do believe I'm now the place where I kind of dreamed to be a few years ago. And, you know, it was a lot of hard work and a lot of things to get here. I mean, we are far from success. Obviously, we are a Series A stage company. So we're, like, really in the early stages in our journey. But I try to remind myself that the end goal is not the only goal, right? The journey itself is the goal, but as I mentioned, we're in almost year six, we're entering year six next year, and we are far from the finish line. So that's probably, a 10-year journey, best case scenario. So if you're not having fun, if you're not enjoying the journey itself, it's very hard, because why would you invest so much time then you get a positive outcome and that's it, and you kind of suffered the 10 years to get there. It's just not worth it. But, you know, I do exactly what as I mentioned, like I dreamed about doing. So I have a lot of fun.
Well, that's amazing to hear. You know, the roller coaster journey of starting a business, of being a founder, can often be one of, you know, suffering. It can be one of pulling my hair out, working late nights, stressing about everything. And it sounds like that hasn't as much been the case for you. What has helped you kind of be a little more grounded, or choosing to see it with joy instead of just stressing about all the unknowns and the curveballs that get thrown your way, right?
Yeah. So I do think that the stress is real. The long hours is real. I kind of work most of the days of the week, and I'm very long hour stretches. But again, I did that before being a founder. I was a consultant. I used to work, 12 to 15 hour days. And the reason why I do that, I am very excited about building. And I believe that building something meaningful requires hard work. And it's not personal, right? It's like, it's not any founder, anyone will kind of go through this journey. So that's not something that now I see as like necessarily like a cost or something outrageous. So that helps decrease the cost factor a little bit. And what I do personally to kind of escape or like get a break from this craziness is my family. I have a 4-year-old daughter, and I know she was born in one of very kind of hard times of tent, where we were like not clear if we survived. We had money on the bank for like another 3 or 4 months. So definitely when she was born, I had a harder time being able to disconnect or even like seeing how family could help. I would at the time see as a distraction or something like, oh my God, how are we going to have this baby if I don't have time left in my day? But if fast forward 4 years, I think I definitely understand now that, especially for founders, like you got to get the way to disconnect. You got to get a way to change through the charge. And to me, it's my time now. I spend a few hours a day with her every single day, playing, kind of undivided attention. And I spend the rest of my working hours working. So also my waking hours like working. So if I didn't have that family break, that would be a lot harder. And I think, mental health wise and all of that.
Yeah. Do you have, at this point, is the business at a place where you can set kind of predictable boundaries in terms of like my day starts around the same time, ends around the same time, or is it still, kind of always in flex and you're not able to have those consistent rhythms?
I do have consistent rhythm, but I would argue you can have that from day one because, I have it again, very almost like same time. Maybe there's let's say plus or minus 1 hour, the time I go to bed. If there's something that is busier on the busier side, then I probably cut 1 hour of sleep. But I really try to protect sleep as much as I can, which means that my time is roughly set. So I start early. I'm in California. We have folks in Europe, East Coast. So I start my day early. I probably start working around 6:30 the latest in front of my computer. Go all the way to around 5. Go get my daughter from school from about 5. Stay with her from 5. I should say 8, 9 when she goes to bed, and then I work for another 1 or 2 hours before sleeping. And again, that's my buffer for when things are really bad, then I stay until midnight, 1 a.m., whatever it takes. But the next morning, I probably wake up around the same time. So I think that is, different founders have different productivity hacks and whatever works for them. But I find it that I've been having this quasi-stable schedule for the past, 3 years at least.
It's huge. That's huge. And you mentioned prioritizing sleep, which is something we didn't even get a chance to talk about this, but my actual business that I run outside of a podcast is doing, performance coaching for leadership teams, for that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And sleep is one of the ones that is harder to convince really kind of high productive, ambitious people actually matters. Mm-hmm. So what for you, was it just experience? Like noticing that, hey, when I get really good sleep, I can't deny the impact. Like what was it for you?
I think it's just to me, it was the informal part was just listening to my body. Like I try to aim for 8 hours of sleep. I probably can't. So I'm more on the 7, but I have a material productivity decrease the next day if I sleep less than say 6 hours. Like I can feel it. And again, as I mentioned, I was a consultant. There were times when you were sleeping 2 hours a night for 2 weeks, and you just power through, like, you know, you survive, but it's just like terrible for many ways. And entrepreneurship, as much as you have to run fast, is a marathon, right? So there's no point burning yourself in the first two months. So I always had this intuition of like, yeah, not even intuition, but like feeling my body and feeling my cognition and seeing that like my sleep is directly related to that. But if one game changer, and I recommend you share that with your customers, is like there's a book called Why We Sleep. I forgot the name of the author. It's amazing because it's a data-driven, science-based explanation of, hey, this is why sleeping matters, and those are the things going to happen to your brain and to you if you don't. And therefore, your conclusion is like, well, it's a kind of like working one extra or two extra hours while tired is probably worse than sleeping on time, waking up refreshed the next morning. You probably spend half an hour to do the same task with higher quality, right? So that's and of course, different people have different sleeping needs. Like some people are wired in a way that they need 5 hours of sleep, 4 hours.
Right.
Yeah, good for them. They shouldn't sleep 8 because then it's as bad as if I sleep 4 hours. But now listen to your body, understand what's that for you. And then you kind of follow that. And the other thing is like if you're a morning person or if you're a night person, listen to that. I'm a morning person. So waking up at 5:30 and being from my computer at 6, I'm full productivity. My brain is at full mode and I can't perform as well as a 6 a.m. meeting as I can at 11 a.m. Now, I'm not great at night, right? So then in order to do that, like after 5 p.m., my brain decreases crazy. So that's why I also design my day to be more focused in early mornings and less focused at night. And then some people are the opposite. So if you're the opposite, sure, don't try to have meetings at 6 a.m. because you're going to punish your body and probably not get the best out of it.
I love that. Yeah, there was a great book by Daniel Pink, and it's just called WHEN, like W-H-E-N. And he was talking about just being thoughtful around when you're at your best in different areas. Like some may be, you know, I'm at my best cognitively when I need to make decisions, when I need to, you know, do creative work at these hours. And he's like, well, then put that work mm-hmm. in those hours. Mm-hmm. And if you're better relationally in the afternoon, well, then do the kind of meetings and the catch-ups and stuff in the afternoon. Like craft the schedule around when you think it's easiest for you to be in that mode, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say as a founder, frankly, you craft the company. You craft the company culture and processes around that. So going back to my co-founder, who I mentioned, Jerome, he's a night owl and he lives in Paris. And I'm an early riser and I live in the West Coast. I'm living in Las Vegas now. So he works well. Throughout our time, he worked pretty well for me to start early and for him to work until late. So that gave us, even between SF or at the time was in the Bay Area and Paris, it gave us like, you know, a good 8 hours coverage in terms of time zone, because I will be up 3 hours each before your average Bay Area employee, and he will be late 3 hours past the anybody in Paris. So we kind of managed to have a pretty big coverage. And we kind of designed the company structure and processes around that. So we have a lot more meetings in the morning because that's the highest overlap between all the time zones. And we have more individual work, in my case, in my afternoon, in his case, earlier morning. So again, this is not what maximizes my performance, because I would prefer to have more like hard work in the morning and meetings in the afternoon when I'm less productive. But on the other hand, like, you know, it's what the best common denominator for the entire company. And that's why I think Teams can work pretty well as a remote company with even like a large time zone spread when some other companies can't, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the thing I like about that is you kind of, the data-driven way that you're seeing this, I think override some of the emotional traps I see certain founders get in, which is, I don't know why, there's a hang up of like me crafting anything around what's best for me feels selfish, or whatever, versus saying, hey, if this is going to help me be my best, that's best for everybody, you know? And so let's take the opportunity we have, which is we get to decide when things happen and what order they happen. That's good for everybody, right?
Yeah, because I mean, at the end of the day, especially in the early stages, first 5, but even like 10 employees, like the founders have a disproportional impact on the company, not only because of the vision, the mission, but they're probably experts. They're probably someone that understands this pain point very deeply. So yeah, their skills must be maximized, right? Like, and if it's not, then it's harder for the business to succeed. So I personally had the same. It's like, oh yeah, no, it's better for me. I'm not so sure, because I don't like to be top down. Like, our culture is a flat right. culture, is empowering people. So that kind of feels a little bit weird when you say, well, I'll make this decision because it's better for me. But in the early stages, it's definitely important. I think that impact, it's going to be diluted, right, like with the founder over time, as you start hiring like more teams and you start to have like layers and things like that, which is where we are today a little bit. But even that, I think, you know, the founder is always going to be important. Think about, there's something I have a coach as well, and I really like her. One of the things she told me that makes sense is like, now think about what the main, even like tech leaders of big companies do. If you look at their org chart, it reflects what they like and what they don't like. So think about Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg brought the COO, like Sheryl Sandberg, like relatively early, and she owned all business things. Revenue, marketing, operations, whatever. He kept all the engineering things. Like, he had his part of the org was all, it was very fragmented with most of the engineering product stuff, because he likes that. He doesn't like probably as much the business part. So as a founder, you have the privilege of designing the company structure based on what you're good at and what you like. And that should maximize the company potential as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, we talk about like this idea of your unique ability, and the best use of your time is going to be anytime you're in that unique ability, which is what you're best at and you most enjoy, gives you the most energy. Mm-hmm. What does that look like for you? Like, what is that kind of, when I'm doing this element of the business, I know I'm a huge value add, versus I've delegated some of this stuff, let somebody else do that because that's not my ability.
Yeah, I think to me, like anything that is customer facing, so thinking about the customer problem, building what the customer needs, putting out there and getting feedback, and like that to me are all things that really energize me. And selling, for the matter, just like having the customer interactions, and the same with investors. So like being that kind of internal, external kind of communication or layer, this is something that really gets me excited. I'm less excited about the deep technical things. I'm not a engineer, so how exactly the technical infrastructure works, like I don't think I can make good judgments there. So definitely something I empower people. That kind of the running of some of the day-to-day processes of like, you know, finance and like that kind of things as well. Like, I tend to hire people and delegate a lot of those things. But frankly, this is something that is still an ongoing learning. Like, as a founder, first you learn more about yourself, and second, those things may change, because the exactly how each of those jobs should be done are executed depending on where the company is in its life cycle, its team may change, right? I used to be the only business person in the team until we were 5 or 6 people. So it was me and engineers. So I would do everything from legal to sales to operations to marketing, like literally everything. I like that, right? So, but obviously that's not scaled. Like, you cannot build a company doing that. So over time, you have to start doing that yourself and breaking more into leaders and being less of the player and start being the coach. And to me, that was not it was a learning, because at the end of the day, that was a superpower, right? Being able to do all those roles yourself and get the company to, you know, 200, 300K ARR alone, it is a superpower that helps you start the company. But that superpower is kind of irrelevant when you get to $1 million AR and have to start thinking about scaling, because then it's almost detrimental if you think about it, because you shouldn't be doing 7 jobs as somebody that has a team now that can do the job for you. So I'd say that transition was something that I learned a lot. So the longer of saying that, like, yeah, the answer to your question is different today than it was 2 years ago. And I'm pretty sure it's going to be different from how it's going to be 1 or 2 years in the future.
Yeah. I mean, it's a pattern we see over and over again, which is when there's only so many people, the great ability is the generalist. It's, mm-hmm. I found a way to do this, and it saved us money because we didn't have the money to hire a specialist for that. And that's my superpower. But like you said, at some point that superpower becomes like a super choke, mm-hmm. where we can't grow bigger now because too many things are coming through me, and I need to open up the channel. I need more people doing this, which increases our capacity and our capability to grow. But sometimes I wonder if you experience this, it can be for emotional reasons that it's difficult for that founder to pass certain things off because of fear of, you know I know how to do this. What if that person doesn't know how to do this? Or I have control. My hands are in everything, and this feels like a loss of control. Did you experience any of that, like emotional resistance to passing things off, or was it always pretty logical and easy to take that step?
I think, you know, I'm definitely on the logical and easy camp, because in a sense, like, again, I'm a very pragmatic person, and it's kind of how I approach life and approach things for that matter. I think what is important to founders, though, and I think that we kind of learn the hard way, is knowing the timing of that transition. If you like, and I think that to me, the right time is product market fit, which is, again, it's elusive, it's a gray area. So it's never like, it's precise, but like, it's getting the feeling of like product market fit. If you make the switch too early before product market fit, bad idea, because whatever you scale on the other side, it's gonna be just like too much people that don't fully understand what needs to be done. And that's confusion, that's chaos, that's slow you down. And I think we heard that during Y Combinator. And I probably didn't see it as clearly back then when it's just theory, kind of going through this journey, you know, scaling, and then you're like, the problem is probably not as there as we thought. And then you see the consequences of that. So that's what I would encourage founders to really be, because, like, I would say you talked about the fear, but I would say there's an opposite force pushing founders to scale, which is the one of like, now I'm building my kingdom. Like, you know, 50 people means that now we're made and we are a successful company. And the answer is like, no. If you have the product market fit and the market is pulling you, like, yeah, sure, that's, and then you're going to try to go as fast as you can on that journey. But doing this won't bring success, if that matter. Or like founders, now I have those very fancy people working for me. That's not going to get your customers to buy more if you're not selling the right product, right? So that is a little bit of like, that time is very tricky. And I think it's very hard to get it right. And so I encourage your founders to spend a lot of time thinking about it.
That's fantastic advice. Fantastic advice. I mean, one thing I think, you seem to, as much as you are logical, you also are very good at the intuition side of listening to your body about sleep and listening to your customers about the product. You mentioned if, you know, there's a stage where we're pushing, like, yeah, we're getting success, but we're pushing, like we're forcing our way into that opportunity. And we're, you know, asking for, stop, listen, pay attention to this. But then there's a switch that you mentioned where it's pulling, where it's like, whoa, there's been a switch in momentum where we're doing less pushing and the market is pulling this product from us. Is that somewhat of an indicator of, hey, I think we really have found some things that are working here and we can think about scale now?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. It is one. And again, trying to shut down every distraction, potential distraction to this signal, because, you know, what can be pulling you can be investor, right? Can be suddenly your segment. Think about your AI company now. And it was a little bit our case as we're going through Y Combinator 3 years ago. like our segment in embedded fintech, it was the hottest place in fintech, and fintech was probably the hottest of all industries. So in that world, you get investors coming to you, they're pulling, they are like throwing money at you. That doesn't mean success. That doesn't mean that your customers want your product. That doesn't mean that you got product market fit. So that's one example. Or you may have your team that like, now because you've brought a certain profile of people, they want to hire, they want to scale. So that is another force that can pull you on that direction. But I think you're right that like you should try to shut down me. It's very hard, but you should try to shut down any of those and focus on the one that matters, which is the customers, the market. Unless that is pulling you, the other ones won't generate pull. Because again, it's easy to like, oh, but I get this fancy investor and they have portfolio companies, so that's gonna get me customers too. It's like, that's probably true if your product is already there and then it's gonna accelerate and it could be a good reason to do that. But if that's not the case, what you're gonna get is like a few introductions that are not gonna go anywhere. And then what, right? So
yeah.
Again, this is, to me, it's not a 0 to 1. This is a 1 to 10, but it's the most important decision that you can do in this kind of transition from 0 to 1 and 1 to 10 phase.
I love that. Yeah, there's a framework called the startup J curve that I'll probably butcher some of the exact stages, but I know the idea is at the beginning, you have your hypothesis. It's the initial, I think this is needed. Here's the service or the offering or the product that's going to solve this problem. But then stage two is the experimentation that you were talking about earlier of like, hey, we put it out there and we're starting to get our first data back and our feedback back and all that kind of stuff. And it's going to stage three, which is the bottom of the curve, the toughest part, which is finding the product market fit. And they talk about that often people take things that were meant to be after that and do it before that, which is decide on the business model, hire people, try to scale. And they're like, no, that needs to be after the product market fit will determine what your business model is. Yeah. It will determine who you need to hire. And once you've got that nailed, you can kind of go on that up curve of the J, which is, all right, let's now nail this. Let's now scale this. We got the system, the process, let's get people behind it. That's kind of what I'm hearing. It sounds like it follows a little bit of that wisdom and logic, right?
Yeah, Zanny. Obviously, the hard part here is knowing this product market fit, right? Like,
yeah.
If it was obvious, then I think it would be easy. But it's hard because definitely you get conflicting signals. You get, well, we closed 3 great customers this quarter. Wow, does it mean that now should we plan for the next 5 customers next quarter? Like, maybe the next quarter comes with nothing, right? Then it's like, wow, what does it mean? You know, like, well, those 3 customers love the product. They're buying more. But what are the next 10? And it's like, so it's not, I'd say it's not a black and white. It's definitely a nuanced thing. But I think I would encourage founders to really pay attention to trying to figure it out.
Cool. Super helpful, man. This has been awesome. I really appreciate your time. My final question is just, I like to always ask this with each person. What has got you most excited right now about the future of Tent?
And what goes most excited is like, you know, we're launching a few new features and products. And I think our vision has always been there, but the step-by-step to accomplish that vision has never been clear based on everything what we learned. Now customers are loving what we're doing. They're pulling more to your point. And we know what we need to build next. And then we can. So that's something that gets me very excited because the promise of what we're doing is massive, right? Like again, if what we're doing is right, it changes insurance, one of the largest industries on earth. So we're very excited to be part of it. Going back to your question, like the hard ups and downs and the long hours, to me, they're fun. There's not a problem really. And that's why we do what we do.
I love it. Thank you for your time, man. I know I have really benefited from just your perspective of keeping it a little more rational, enjoying the journey a little more, even trusting my intuition, you know, around what I need or what the business is doing. So this has been super helpful, Mateus. Thank you for being here. I really appreciate you, man.
Thank you, Drew.
Founders, thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast and hop into our monthly founder email so we can ensure you stay on the edge of peak performance and massive business results.